complete terror. But she's got a soft spot for the military. I saw it in action. She really likes the military, which is a first for a sex state. And you look like an Abercrombie and Fitch model. Sorry. Not sorry. Knuckles said, that is the most sexist bullshit thing I've ever heard. They reached the car and Kurt said, yeah, except it worked. Look, she's good people. She's still finding her way and I knew she'd fight this just to prove she wasn't a wallflower. I had to defeat that. And I used you. It worked. They entered the car and Kurt put it in drive. He said, don't get all pissy about it. Christ, I'm the one dealing with integrating females. Knuckles looked out the window then said, I guess that's all I'm good for now, integrating females, or getting them to vote your way. Kurt laughed and said, no, that's not all you're good for. There's a reason I wanted you to see that meeting, and it's because of Pike. Yeah? How's that? Pike is on to something. He doesn't know what it is, and neither do I. But he's peeling something rotten. I put him on that thread, and he's unwinding it. Knuckles waited for more, and when none came, he said, okay, so what? That's par for the course, and I don't even play golf. Kurt looked at him and said, Shoshana was in that room during the VTC yesterday. I know it, and you know it. No matter what I said today, the original mission is gone in Pike's mind. That's what I meant when I asked you if you'd really listened. Knuckles nodded, feeling out of his depth. Wondering if this was what Pike went through every time he talked to Kurt, he said, and what does that mean? It means I need you to keep Pike on track. I don't know what the fuck Shoshana's up to, but whatever it is, Pike will see it through. Those two are connected. And how am I going to help? Pike's going to go on the warpath. I know him. It'll happen sooner or later, and he'll need some shooters. He'll ask for you. Knuckles couldn't believe the 3D chess moves Kurt was making, and he honestly didn't like the implications. He said, sir, I'm not deploying to trick Pike. I'm not sure what this conversation is about, but I can't do that. He locked eyes with Kurt, afraid of the anger, but said, I can't. Kurt pulled into the underground garage, passing a sign for Blaisdell Consulting, the cover organization for the task force. He threw the car into park and said, I would never ask you to do such a thing. That's not what I meant. He sat still for a minute, then turned and said, Pike is doing what we all would. It's why I sent him on this. But sometimes what's pure isn't pure. Knuckles said, that's bullshit, and you know it. Kurt smiled and said, yes, I do. Pike's going to solve this problem, but he needs someone to keep him in balance. Knuckles barked a laugh, trying to gain a foothold on what Kurt wanted and failing. He said, yeah, he'll solve it, no doubt. But what makes you think he'll need shooters? It's just an alpha operation. Kurt said, we have a sanctioned mission from the Oversight Council, which is to prevent the selling of nuclear triggers to terrorists. Pike knows that, but he also has a sweet spot for Shoshana, and she's a fucking cyclone. He turned to Knuckles and said, Pike is pure, and so are you. Aaron is gone, but he's at the heart of this thing. Shoshana doesn't care about nuclear triggers. All she wants is Aaron back home, and he might be dead already. Whatever the truth is, it's going to twist Shoshana until she explodes. Pike'll see it happening, and he'll be torn between his mission and her. He'll defer to her, defer to hunting for Aaron. I know him. He can't do otherwise. Your job will be to get him back on the path of our mission. He turned the car off, looking out the windshield, lost in thought. He glanced back at Knuckles and said, trust me, Pike's going to want some shooters. And I'm sending you.
32.
Aaron took his bowl of rancid rice and retreated to the corner of the cell, putting his back against the wall, surrounded by the Soot clan. Since the fight the night before, he'd taken to eating with them at every meal. They had some sort of protected status in the jail, and he could use all the help he could get. As usual, he committed half of his meager rations to the pot for those who were being punished by the guards. A small price to pay for the benefits he was gaining. Thomas Naboni took his bowl and sat next to him. He ate in silence for a moment, waiting on the guards to leave. When they did, he passed a piece of torn paper to Aaron. Aaron opened it, seeing a note from Alex. It was succinct. I'm okay. Your friend has ensured that happens. Don't worry about me. But don't leave me when you go. Beside the sentence was a smiley face. That was all. But it said much more than it seemed. One, it relieved the enormous worry he'd had about her condition. If she had the ability to actually write down a smiley face, she was doing okay. Two, the note told him that she still trusted him to get her out. Still believed in his James Bond, Mossad, non-existent miracle ability. It gave him pain, but he would get her out. Sooner or later. Aaron nodded, then said, Thank you. This means a great deal to me. Thomas said, She is being strong. Trust me. Her incarceration is not easy. All I did was prevent any assaults against her. It would be better for you to confess to whatever you've done, and get her out of here. She won't last. Aaron said, I've done nothing. I mean that. We were abducted in Johannesburg, drugged, then driven to Durban. I was tortured there, and now I'm here. Thomas leaned his head back, looking suspicious. He said, You weren't captured here? In Maseru? I don't even know where Maseru is. Thomas took in the words, then said, But you're here, in this prison. What the fuck does that mean? There was a commotion outside the door to their cell room, and Aaron saw the guard become agitated, snapping to attention. Everyone began vibrating and chattering. A man entered, and Aaron recognized him as the African at the meeting in Johannesburg, Lieutenant General Jonathan Mosibo. Thomas fell back at his entrance, scurrying away, his star wilting under the sun of the general. Aaron saw true fear on his face. The general advanced on Aaron, ignoring all else in the cell. He reached him, and Aaron put down his bowl of rice, sitting cross-legged, and saying not a word. Mosibo said, So you've survived. I wouldn't have expected it. Aaron remained mute. Mosibo bent over, and the guard known as Lurch circled behind Aaron. Mosibo cupped his chin and said, I want to know what you're doing with the Americans. Aaron said, I have no idea what you're talking about. Lurch hammered him at the top of the neck, right where the skull met the spine, eliciting a scream. Aaron fell forward onto his face, and Lurch grabbed him, jerking him upright. Panting in the pain, Aaron said, I don't know anything about any Americans. I don't even know where I am. Mosibo slapped him. Not hard, but enough to telegraph that worse was coming. He said, There is a United States Special Forces team here. I want to know why. They claim it's just security assistance for the embassy. Did you call them? Aaron laughed and said, How? How would I do that? And if I did, why am I still here? Mosibo's face contorted into a rage, and Aaron realized he was paranoid, truly paranoid crazy. Looking for the boogeyman everywhere, even in this cell that he owned. Before he could get punched again, Aaron blurted out, "I don't even know who you are. I have no idea why I'm here. I'm nothing but a diamond merchant." The comment took the heat off the boiling water. Masibo nodded and said, "I want to know why you were in Johannesburg." "I told the South African in Durban, the one who questioned me. I gave him all my answers. Ask him. He knows I'm nothing important." Masibo squatted down, getting face to face. "I don't trust that man either. He tells me to keep you alive, and I wonder why. If you're not important, it would be much easier to bury you under a bridge, but he won't allow it. Who are you?" Realizing his life was on the line, Aaron showed fear, blubbering like the corporate whore he was supposed to be. Through his weeping, he said, "I promise, I know nothing. I'm a nobody, a nobody." In a pique, Masibo lashed a hand forward, cuffing Aaron in the head. He said, "Maybe your little friend will provide some answers." Aaron's face snapped up, locking eyes with Masibo. And he saw the man inwardly shrink at the murder in his eyes, the violence held just below the surface. It was nothing overt, but Aaron realized he'd made a mistake. Masibo had gained a glimpse into Aaron's true self. Masibo regained his composure from the show of fear and leveraged the weakness in Aaron's response. He said, "You will tell me who you are, or I'll take it out on her. I'll be back." He cuffed Aaron's head again and said, "You understand?" Aaron looked at him and nodded, but he could still see the fear in Mosibo's eyes. He hadn't meant to let slip who he was, what he was capable of. But he had. And it had bought him time. How much? He didn't know. Lurch kicked him in the kidney, knocking him forward, and they left the cell. Gradually, the man inside began to stir. Thomas came forward, looking at his face and saying, "Did they harm you?" "No, nothing worse than I felt before." Thomas said, "Who are you? For real?" "I'm a nobody. I keep telling everyone that." Thomas sat back on his heels and said, "You are a liar. That much is plain." Aaron sighed and said, "I'm a nobody here. I have no idea who that guy is, or why I'm locked up." He looked at Thomas and said, "Who are you? As long as we're being all honest." Thomas looked toward the door, making sure the guards were out of earshot, and said, "I'm a nobody as well. Here." "What does that mean?" Thomas crossed his legs, settling in. He said, "You're not some insignificant person. Somewhere, you're a somebody. And I need a somebody. Your friend said, 'Don't leave me when you go.' Why would she say that?" "She places faith in me. She truly is nothing in this game. And she's my responsibility. I told you that before. We're trapped in a design not of our making." Thomas looked at him for a moment, then said, "I believe that to be true, but it's not the full story. General Masibo has only visited this prison twice before, and each time it was for me." He raised his shirt, showing jagged scars across his belly. Aaron saw the damage and said nothing. Thomas said, "I know why that is. I had something to give him, which I did not." He dropped his shirt and said, "But I don't know why he would come for you." Aaron shook his head and said, "I honestly don't know why either. I have nothing. I've done nothing. I'm not a threat to him." Thomas smiled and said, "Yes, you are. You may not realize it, but you are. And I could use a threat." Aaron barked out a laugh and said, "The only threat I am, you saw last night. I can fight, but that does little good in here. Thomas smiled again, his teeth as white as snow in the darkness. But you have friends, don't you? You have connections beyond what you've shown. A government, perhaps? Aaron sighed, thinking of the Mossad, and the lack of help he was so close to achieving. He said, No, I have no government willing to free me here. Disappointed, Thomas said, So you're not being sought? Nobody is trying to help you? Aaron glanced at him and looked away, but once again his eyes gave away the answer. Thomas saw the hope leaking out and said, You have someone. Someone's coming to find you, yes? Not a government? That's good, too. That's okay. Who is he? Aaron said nothing. Thomas said, He can help us both. You have a secret. And so do I. Aaron let the word settle, understanding he now had an ally. He said, It's a she, and yes, she's coming. When she does, you want to be on my side. I promise. 33. Shoshana watched the car pull into the roundabout in front of the Victoria and Alfred Hotel, then saw her target exit. She took a left into a tourist car park and pulled into a spot that gave her a view of the entrance. Before committing, she wanted to know if he was entering the hotel or going deeper into the famed V&A waterfront of Cape Town, South Africa. Originally constructed as a simple stopover point for Dutch East India Company ships traveling to India and the Far East, it had transformed in the modern era into a tourist promenade, with everything from a giant aquarium to a Ferris wheel that looked like a miniature London Eye. Even though it was becoming overrun with pedestrian walkways, shops, and restaurants, it was still a working port, and Shoshana hoped her target was doing something other than getting a beer. In truth, she was a tad bit aggravated at the slow-moving surveillance effort, and wanted nothing more than to corner her target and rip off his head, spilling out the secrets that he held. But she couldn't, because Pike had demanded they develop the situation. She feared the delay was putting Aaron in danger. She'd lost the ability to sleep at night, worried beyond measure about what was happening to her touchstone, her gateway to normalcy. She didn't realize it, but her fear of losing Aaron was driving her to become exactly what she was trying so hard to leave behind. A monster that shouldn't walk the earth. She saw the target bypass the entrance to the hotel, moving deeper into the waterfront. She exited the car, taking up a loose follow, keeping his blonde head in sight in the distance, and wondering why his mission even mattered, whatever it was. There was nothing in Cape Town for her. Yeah, the man they called Apple Watch might be doing something heinous, but who cared what the task force thought? He was a bad man like a bazillion other folks in the world. Divining his evil plot wouldn't get her Aaron. Only skinning him alive would do that. She was regretting volunteering for this task. She should have followed the black man. In Tel Aviv, they'd learned that the task force had identified Apple Watch's iPhone in Cape Town, South Africa, at a hotel in the old Muslim section of Bokop. They'd done a hasty site survey via online tools, and then had flown to the bottom of Africa to interdict the target. The flight route had been circuitous, forcing them first to go to Europe before traveling back down to the edge of the earth in South Africa, and the time lost had eaten at Shoshana. She'd become incensed when Pike had developed a surveillance plan on the hotel, but no follow-on takedown. No planning for exfiltration with the target, no interrogators, no request for support assets whatsoever. She'd eventually interrupted the operations order, saying, I see a lot of sneak and peek crap to set this guy up, but nothing about taking him down. When are we doing that? We're wasting time with this tiptoe stuff. The room had gone quiet, all eyes on Pike. In a measured tone, he'd said, "Shoshana, we don't have authority to do that. Not yet, anyway. We have to build the target package and then get approval." She heard the words and felt betrayed, her earlier fears coming home. They didn't care about Aaron. They cared only about themselves. She'd snapped to her feet and said, "I told you, I wouldn't stand for any bullshit. That man knows where Aaron is, and I'll take him down by myself if I have to." Pike shook his head, saying, "And then what?" "And then I ring him out. Find Aaron." She'd glared at him, then Jennifer, and started to walk to the hotel door. Pike had said, "What if he doesn't know where Aaron is?" She stopped, the anger flaring out, saying, "Then I move on to the next one." Pike said, "What next one?" "We don't have a next one yet. And what happens when our target set realizes you've hit him? You think they'll just continue like business as usual? Or shift, perhaps move Aaron to a new location? Or kill him?" She balled her fists and let out a guttural animal sound, something from deep within her soul. She knew he was right, and that fact was eating her from the inside out. She wanted to fight. She was like a wolf caught in a bear trap, ripping its limbs to get free. The action itself doing more damage than the trap, but continuing to thrash in a frenzy, nonetheless. She tamped down her instinctual fear, managing to stop her internal struggle. Pike nodded, seeing the change. In a gentle tone, he said, "Shoshana, sit down, please." She did, and he finished the op-ord, detailing trigger and bumper locations. He ended by saying, "Remember, Apple is our only key, and today is just development. We record every thread and then explore those threads. That's the mission." He looked at Shoshana and said, "Can you do that?" She nodded firmly, and he said, "Good. Let's get cracking." They traveled to their designated surveillance bumper locations around the hotel, with Brett on the trigger position inside, and Shoshana on the least likely egress the target would use, the one away from the city center. It aggravated her, but she understood why. 2 hours later, sitting in her rental car parked on Whale Street outside a traditional Cape Malay curry restaurant, she heard the trigger call. All elements, this is Blood. Apple is leaving the Hotel Foxtrot and tending right on Whale Street." Shoshana pricked up at the call. Foxtrot meant he was on foot, no vehicle. And tending meant Blood thought he was taking a right on Whale Street, not a left, which meant he was coming to her. She said, "This is Carrie. I copy." Pike and Jennifer, in the other two bumper positions, did the same, and she saw Apple Watch coming up the hill. She said, "Carrie has the eye, still Foxtrot." She'd wait until he passed her before exiting her vehicle, just in case. He didn't. He stopped at the corner, across the intersection from her position, and a car pulled up heading the other way. He got in the passenger seat, and she put her car in drive. She called the team, gave them a description of the car and the direction of travel, and then passed Pike, headed the other way. She grinned. She was now the only one who could follow in the short term. They wove through the city until they hit Long Street, the target taking a right. Shoshana followed two cars back, immediately hit a throng of pedestrians, and grew afraid of a break in contact. "Pike, this is Carrie. Apple is on Long Street, and this looks like the bar-hopping boozing area. Nothing but pubs and restaurants, with backpackers and locals all over the street. I might lose him." Jennifer came on. "Carrie, this is Coco. I've got visor two blocks up," meaning she was ahead of the target. Shoshana slowed her urgency through the crowds. She heard Jennifer come back on. Pike? Carrie's right. This avenue looks a lot like Bourbon Street.
Got it. No issues now. But it's something to remember if we have to do night ops here. Brett's parallel to the north, and I'm to the south. Target's not getting out without us picking him up.
Shoshana saw the target car pull over next to a two-story building with a hotel on top and a bar on the bottom. Apple left the vehicle, and the car rolled on.
She called, "He's Foxtrot now. I'm passing. It's the Long Street Hotel, some type of social club on the bottom."
She rolled through the intersection, seeing Apple enter, and called,
"I'm off."
34. Johann passed by the Cape Town South African History Museum, entering the expansive green known as the Company's Garden. Once a plot of land that grew the food for the Dutch East India Company outpost, it had been preserved as a park that spanned hectares of terrain, running right next to the Houses of Parliament of South Africa. It was a crowded place with all manner of people, both rich and poor, black and white, and was a good location to conduct a meeting that wouldn't draw attention, especially since both he and the man he was meeting were wanted by South Africa for disobeying the 98 Regulation of Foreign Military Assistance Act. Birthed because of the rampant mercenary activity in the 90s, with less than stellar men working for charlatan organizations that built their false pedigrees on the backs of the success of professionals like Johann, it was a law that caused him to tread lightly in his homeland. He wandered through the gardens, watching the kids play with soccer balls, taking paths that would channelize anyone following him, without appearing as if he was doing anything overt. The winding trails and thick vegetation provided a ready-made surveillance detection route, and were the reason he'd picked this garden to meet the colonel. Walking on a path that wound through the trees all by itself, he approached a group of teenagers and saw one of them stand up, his skin coal black, wearing worn Nike sweats and shoes that were untied. He had the vacant stare of a person feeling no pain but looking to apply some. Johann passed him by, and the group stood up, following.
Shit! Exactly what he didn't need.
The entire point of choosing this location was to sniff out anyone following, not get a police response because of an altercation. The teens were searching for easy prey, and he was simply looking to remain invisible. He turned abruptly, and they all stopped short. Five of them, all stoned. He looked the leader in the eyes and realized there was no reasoning with them. Nike Sweats was panting, sweat rolling off his face, pupils dilated. He didn't care about the police or anything else. He cared about the kill. Strangely, Johann understood. Johann said, "You want to make some money?" Taken aback, Nike Sweats said,
"Yeah.
How?
What you talking about?
You leave me alone, I'll pay you 500 rand. Nike Sweats smiled and said,
"You got 500. Maybe you got more. Maybe I'll take it."
Johann took two steps toward him, closing into his personal space and pulling out a folding knife. He flicked it open and brought it blade first into the man's groin. He said, "You want to make the money or lose your nuts?" Nike Sweats was frozen in place. The others became agitated, not sure of what to do. They'd never been on the receiving end of a hunt. Johann sawed the blade, splitting the cloth of the sweats. He looked at them and said, "He can't speak. You guys want to make some money?" One of them nodded, saying,
Yeah, we'll take the rand. And you can have his balls."
The others laughed, and Johann pulled the knife away. He withdrew his wallet, pulled out several notes, and threw them on the ground. He looked at Nike Sweats and said, "Not everyone is prey around here." He turned and walked away, hearing them scamper on the ground for the money. Johann was incensed. He had a mission, and it was almost short-circuited by a bunch of random losers.
should have fucking gutted them. But he knew he wouldn't, even if he could. They were just a byproduct of the poverty that abounded in Cape Town, and they would end up dying an early death by someone else's hand, not his. Johann continued on the path until it re-entered the main promenade. A statue of the famed politician Cecil Rhodes towering over the pavestones. The outside of the monument now cloaked in protest placards, accusing him of all manner of evil. An indication of the new face of South Africa. He went by it, threading through the woods, until he saw a coffee shop with outdoor tables sprinkled along the garden path. He entered the patio and saw Colonel Lloyd Armstrong sitting under an umbrella, two steaming cups of coffee on the table. He was wearing chinos and a short-sleeved business shirt, his eyes hidden behind a pair of Ray-Ban aviator sunglasses. The attire did nothing to hide his prior profession. A hulking man with his hair cut close to the scalp, he looked like a cartoon version of a lion tamer, right down to the cigar he was smoking. Nobody would mistake him for a banker, regardless of what he was wearing. Johann slid into the seat next to him, hoping for a surprise. He was disappointed. Armstrong said, "Why didn't you just kill those fucks?" Taken aback, Johann said, "Good to see you too, sir." "What fucks?" Armstrong raised his coffee mug and pointed with it. Johann turned and saw the drug-addled group following along his path. Armstrong said, "What did you do? Pay them to leave you alone?" Johann smiled and said, "Yeah, I did. I'm going to claim it as an expense." Armstrong laughed and said, "Always the one to avoid conflict." He turned serious, saying, "But that's not what happened in Lesotho. I got a sit rep. What's the true story?" Johann told him everything that had occurred, giving an assessment that wasn't included in his clinical report. He detailed the atmospherics of Maseru and the impact of the U.S. Special Forces team's arrival, ending with his assessment of General Mosibo's troops. "They aren't that good. In fact, they're shit. You told me earlier that they were some of the best on the continent, but that's not what I saw. How's the training going? Am I wrong?"
"No. They aren't as good as we were told, but they aren't completely raw recruits. They can work an AK and they understand basic fire and maneuver. They're just honing some edges. The first two packages are already back home. We're finishing up with the last one."
"Did you break them out by ability instead of by LDF assignments? Because some areas are going to need more skill than others."
"Yes. They know they'll get separated. They just don't know how yet." "I was waiting on you for that."
Johann leaned back, making sure nobody was within earshot. He said, "I'll have a complete report by tonight, but basically, we'll have four stop groups. The easy ones will be the Parliament building itself, and the television and radio station. The tough ones will be the police headquarters, and the Prime Minister's residence. The police will be a firefight, so we'll need to go in hard. The Prime Minister's residence will be the same. It's hardened, gated, and he has a robust protective detail. But unlike the police headquarters, it's a much more delicate mission. We can't just kill everyone. We'll have to make sure he remains alive." Armstrong said, "I'll need specifics on force sizes, weapons, and contingencies." Johann took a sip of his coffee before answering, then said, "You'll get it tonight, but basically in order of skill. The best fighters go to the residence, second best to the headquarters, and the rest to the television and radio station. The least skilled simply take over the Parliament building. It'll be closed at night with a skeleton security guard force. It's purely symbolic." Armstrong took a sip of his coffee and Johann said, "One thing we can't do is cause the Americans to interfere."
"We won't. We work this quickly, and they won't have a reason to."
Johann said. There's something else that concerns me. The Israeli. What about him?
We went after his partner, and we were eviscerated. She had a team working with her, and the team included Americans.
Armstrong waved his hand in the air, washing away the worry. He said,
I got the report from Andy. I understand it was a mess, but I don't assess it as having an impact on our operation. We went after her, a mistake, no doubt. But my contacts in Israel say there have been no repercussions. We stuck our hand into the flame and got burned. Nobody's looking into it beyond a police response. Nobody is looking for outside influences.
Johann said, nobody but her.
What's that matter? She's a single slash. She can't do anything.
She had help from someone. One of the teams says it was the United States.
Colonel Armstrong barked a laugh and said, no, let's be precise. He said he was choked out by an American. Big difference. I have Americans on this team. They're everywhere, and they have the skill forged from combat. The continent hasn't seen this level of American involvement since the end of the Vietnam War.
Johann said, so you're not concerned? We're dealing with a diamond merchant who's also former Israeli intelligence, and when we try to cauterize a leak, we get annihilated. By the partner of the man we now hold. How much do you know about the background of the diamond dealer? Is he telling the truth?
Armstrong took a sip of his coffee, then said, he was a member of the Lekum. It was an Israeli intelligence organization designed to ferret out nuclear secrets. Their whole purpose was industrial espionage in their quest for the bomb, and they were good at it.
Why does that matter? Some old gray dick from Israeli intelligence is supposed to be a guy I trust. Who do you know inside South African intelligence that you trust now?
Nobody. That's who.
Armstrong said,
he isn't South African. Israel is different. Because of his placement and the sensitivity of the activities back in the day, he has plenty of contacts inside Israeli intelligence. They still call on him from time to time. Shit, he was the guy who helped us build our own bomb.
Johann sat up.
What's that mean?
Armstrong put out his cigar and said,
you were young, but you remember when we gave up our nuclear weapons at the end of apartheid?
Johann laughed and said,
yeah, we were the great saviors, the first to voluntarily relinquish our nuclear weapons.
You and I both know why that happened. Armstrong nodded and said,
because we were afraid of who was going to take over after apartheid ended. Afraid of loose nukes. But that's not the point. Getting the nukes is where our Israeli contact comes in. He, using Lekum assets, is the one who gave us the technology. Project Circle.
35. Shoshana continued slowly down Long Street, keeping an eye on the front door of the club in her rearview mirror, then heard,
this is Coco. I've got a parking spot. I'm Foxtrot, one block up.
Pike said, Coco, your target. Get in there. Blood, blood, what's your status?
One street over, parking now.
Prep a dragon tooth. He's meeting someone, and I want a beacon on that fucker. Break, break. Carry, keep on the target car. Let me know where it goes.
In spite of the fact that she was now out of the action, Shoshana smiled. Pike was working the problem better than most. She checked her rearview mirror, saw the vehicle coming, then said,
I'm on him.
She followed the car down Long Street, watched it turn into a paved lot, and went past before pulling to the side of the road, wishing like hell she was in the hotel. Pike had planned it perfectly, keeping her out of the action.
keeping her from doing anything of substance. 30 minutes later, she was grinning again. Jennifer had said that Apple Watch had met a black man inside the bar and had been passed a key. From there, her target car had circled around and picked him up, and she was the only thing in play as everyone else was on foot. She'd followed the car to the V&A wharf and had decided to stick with Apple, letting the car go free. Someone else could track it, if they could get here quickly enough. She trotted across the street, passing the lobby of the ritzy V&A hotel and a host of taxis and tour cars, seeing the blonde head disappear into the crowd. She followed him through the tourists, passing beer gardens and restaurants, then hit the water of the harbor. He took a right, headed toward a pedestrian bridge that crossed a concrete canal of water leading to a marina. Before he reached it, a light started flashing, and a man prevented anyone from crossing. Shoshana looked into the harbor, saw a sailboat approaching, and realized the single footbridge was a miniature drawbridge. It began to swing away, letting the boat through, and she was stuck on the same side with her target. She went to the breakwater, watching a mother and two kids feed the seagulls. She took a seat on a bench, trying to remain invisible. She kept her eyes on the target and received a call from Pike. "Carrie, Carrie, what's the situation?" "Last call was a dismount at the wharf. Give me a lock on." Afraid he was about to pull her off, she said, "Crossing the footbridge. No clear direction or purpose. I'm still good. Heat state is ice."
"Don't fuck with me, Carrie."
The bridge took an agonizingly long time to transfer back. She said, "I'm not Nephilim. Have some trust." He said,
"We're at the wharf. We're coming. Just keep him in sight and rotate out when I call."
The light went off, and the pedestrians began to cross. She followed the target, saying,
"Okay, as long as I'm not forced into something before you get here."
She heard him panting on the radio, clearly running his ass off.
"Don't you do a fucking thing."
The target passed the famed clock tower of the wharf, right in front of the gateway ferry to Robben Island, the location of the desolate block of granite on which Nelson Mandela had been imprisoned for most of his adult life. He reached the lower level of a two-story mall and walked in with a purpose. It was a shallow opening with few people. If she entered at his intrusion point, she would be burned. If she didn't, he would accomplish whatever he was doing inside. But he was boxed inside the mall, and she needed more manpower to continue the surveillance. She couldn't do it alone as much as she wanted to. Every fiber of her being told her to follow, Aaron at the forefront of her mind, begging the target to give her reason to interdicting. But she did not. She deferred to the team. She called Pike, told him the status, and rolled off, going to the right of the building to a set of stairs next to a garish Ripley's Believe It or Not attraction. She went up them, and then took a seat on a bench, waiting on the cavalry to penetrate the mall. She heard,
"We can't get across. The pedestrian bridge is rotating for a boat."
No sooner had that come across than the target exited right in front of her, moving to a placard on a wall, pretending to study it while glancing at the door. The realization hit her immediately, along with how lucky she had been. Surveillance detection route. He had entered the mall solely to pick out anyone following, taking the escalators to the second floor, then rapidly exiting. Anyone who did the same would clearly be on him. And she'd beaten his game, all because she wanted to prove to Pike she wasn't a lone wolf. She smiled and clicked her radio.
"He's back on the street, and I'm on him."
"Shoshana, back off. Your heat state has got to be molten by now."
She said nothing, letting the target go by her,
not moving at all as long as she had him in sight. He walked about 100 meters, leaving the tourist area, and entering the working port. He took a left at a jetty full of warehouses, and she stood. She walked for about 30 meters, making sure he wasn't doing more counter-surveillance work, then sprinted to the corner of the warehouses. She heard, "Shoshana, we're coming across. Give me a damn status." She pulled up short, then stuck her head around the corner. She saw the target 70 meters away, unlocking a door on the row of warehouses, then disappearing inside. She said,
"I've got him. He's on the jetty past the tourist area. He's inside some shipping warehouse. But I can't get close."
Pike said, "Pull off. We'll meet you at the clock tower." She saw the target appear again, closing the door. She said,
"He's out. He's out. He's headed back my way. I'm off."
She slipped around to the other side of the jetty where the boats docked and unloaded. She ignored the looks of the hard men on the dock, waiting on the target to pass. When he did, she called Pike, telling him Apple was on the way and running right into him, and that he had control.
"What are you going to do?"
"Check out that warehouse."
She slunk down the jetty, trying to look like she belonged, dodging forklifts and staring eyes. She reached the door she'd seen Apple exit, glanced left and right, then turned the handle. It refused to move.
Shit.
She considered picking the lock, but one look at the activity around her, and she knew that would be a non-starter. She studied the lock set, and then had an idea. It was a 6-pin restricted key cylinder built by the Swedish lockmaker Assa Abloy, something she knew about from her work in Israel. She took a knee, set her cell phone camera on macro, and took a frontal shot of the keyhole. If Pike's vaunted task force didn't have the ability to do anything with the photo, she knew a group that did. 36. The mention of Project Circle only increased Johan's unease about the mission. He'd been deceived plenty of times in the past, all to get him to ply his skills. The last man who'd done it was the American he'd worked for a year ago, the one who'd given him his H-1B visa, which had caused the Lesotho security men to spike. That American had caused the death of many, many innocents, and had attempted to use Johan to cover up his transgressions. Johan had unfortunately done so before learning the truth, and then had slaughtered the man in his office, leaving his broken body as a warning to others.
What does South Africa's nuclear program have to do with Lesotho? So this guy, our mundane contact in the Diamond Exchange, was intimately involved in our development of nuclear weapons?
Yes.
And that doesn't give you concerns about what happened in Tel Aviv?
No, it gives me confidence. He would know if it was anything more than bad luck and unforeseen skill.
Johan nodded, saying nothing.
Armstrong said, "What's going through your mind?"
"It just sounds more complicated than a simple coup in Lesotho. More in play here."
Armstrong leaned over the table, getting eye to eye. He said,
"It is more complicated, but not for you. You do your mission, and don't worry about the rest. That's my problem."
Johan nodded, now wishing he had 2 fingers of scotch instead of coffee. He said,
"Who's taking over in Lesotho? Why are we being hired?"
"The diamond merchant hired us for the oldest reason on earth. Money. As for who's taking over, it's nothing but more of the same from all over the continent. Someone wants power. The Prime Minister is as corrupt as a rusty nail. His deputy will assume the position, with General Masibo remaining as the true power, as the head of the LDF. And the king will remain the king. It's nothing you haven't seen before.
A transfer from one asshole to another.
And the country? What will happen when we're successful?
Armstrong looked at him with true mirth and said,
Seriously? Don't tell me Lilyboy is now concerned with the local population.
Johann glanced away and said, I've seen bad go to worse. He turned back to Colonel Armstrong. And so have you.
Armstrong slapped his shoulder and said, Don't worry about it here. The government will function just like it did. All we're doing is replacing one man with another.
Johann nodded and said, What about the man we captured, the Israeli?
What about him?
I wanted to keep him alive for bargaining in case something went wrong. But given this information, I think it's a risk. I say we smoke him.
Armstrong considered, toying with his cup. He said, No, we leave him in Masebo's hands. Right now we're cut from him. If things go well, we'll let Masebo deal with him. If they go wrong, we still have a bargaining chip with the Israelis.
Johann glared at him and said, I thought the Israelis didn't matter.
Armstrong slapped a hand on the table in irritation, causing the coffee cups to jump. Johann didn't react, keeping his stare. Armstrong said, Just do what I ask. You're hired for a single mission, a tactical mission. Get me the plan and execute.
Johann nodded, took a sip of his coffee and said, Okay, sir. I can do that. How are we looking for armament? A couple took a seat at the table next to theirs, and Armstrong rose, saying, Come, follow me back to my car. They left the restaurant's patio and circled around the statue of Cecil Rhodes, seeing the gang from earlier lying in the grass like a pack of mongrel dogs. They entered a secluded path on the edge of the woodline, and Armstrong said, Andy just went to get the key for the warehouse. He'll report back. But I don't see any hiccups.
Johann said, Who's he getting the key from? Who else is involved?
It's the same guy who got us the safe house in Durban. He works for the man providing the weapons and equipment.
Johann glanced at the colonel but said nothing.
Armstrong said, What?
Do you trust this American?
He's done what he said he'd do so far.
Johann broke a stick off a tree and tossed it. He said, I don't like working with him. What's he gaining? Why is he involved? Money makes people do strange things.
Armstrong said, He's not getting money.
What then?
Don't worry about it. That's my problem.
Come on, sir. What's he getting out of this?
Armstrong stopped on the trail, looked at Johann and said, He's getting something from my connections in the South African Defense Force. Something that they no longer need, but he can use.
You have the SANDF involved in this? How?
I had to get the SANDF involved precisely to prevent them from invading Lesotho because of our coup. They're worried about the interruption of the flow of water. I'm working with the Army headquarters, just letting them know what we're doing and assuring them that that won't happen. Using my connections to prevent mission failure. The American is greasing the skids with money.
Johann nodded, saying, Okay, sir, that makes sense. But I wish you'd include me on the overarching plans.
Armstrong chuckled and said, Johann, you're good, but you're only a tool. Let me worry about the bigger picture. You just execute your plan. That's all you're being paid for, and all you need to worry about.
Johann bit out, Fine, but my tactical operation is predicated on your strategic decisions. You didn't answer the question. What is the American getting from them?
Armstrong sighed and said, Look, Johann, Not everything is black and white like you want. Sometimes we have to do what we don't like. But if it'll alleviate your angst, I'm meeting him tonight. Why don't you come as well? Feel him out. Get some confidence in the mission.
Johann said nothing for a moment, then. Okay. Where?
The old castle. The ceremonial guard out there is actually active duty army recruits. There's a Sandef recruiting station in the back.
Armstrong laughed and said,
My Sandef contact didn't want to be seen with me on the streets. Imagine that.
There was a rustling in the brush, and the mongrel pack of youths appeared, led by Nike Sweats. Armstrong became quiet, waiting on them to pass. When they didn't, he said,
What the fuck do you cuffers want?
Nike Sweats nodded at Johann and said,
He knows, old man.
Johann said, I paid you. I've already paid.
Yes, you have. But he hasn't.
Johann said,
You remember what I said earlier?
That not everyone is prey? You're looking at it right now. Nike Sweat said,
Yeah, I heard you. I just didn't believe it.
The men circled around them, and Johann knew they were committed, but he still believed there was a way out. He looked at Armstrong and saw the violence beginning to build just below the surface. He said,
Sir, don't.
Nike Sweats and one other closed in tight, the rest remaining in a loose circle, sure of their numbers. Armstrong shook his head and said,
Lily boy, like I said, sometimes we do things we don't like. Distasteful things.
He curled his knuckles into a flat ledge and lashed out, his fist striking as fast as the head of a snake, spearing into Nike Sweats' throat. Johann heard a hoarse bark, and the man dropped to the ground, rolling and attempting to scream. All that came out was a guttural moan. Armstrong turned to the man next to him. The boy brought his hands up in a pathetic attempt at defense, and Armstrong grabbed the lead one, twisting his hand backward and locking up the joint. Armstrong looked into his eyes and said,
Jump, Kaffir,
then rotated the wrist in a circle, against the way it was designed. The boy felt the pain like an electric current and literally leapt off his feet to stop it. Armstrong rotated forward and down, and the boy flipped over, hammering the ground on his back. Armstrong let go of his wrist and slammed his fists into the man's face, once, twice, three times. Johann saw his head snap back, bouncing off the gravel, and his eyes roll in his head. Armstrong stood, turned to the remaining youths and said,
You fucks want to die today? Keep pushing.
They ran, exploding away like confetti out of a popped balloon. Johann said, That wasn't necessary. Armstrong said,
Bullshit it wasn't. There was a time those Kaffirs wouldn't have dared to even approach. I saw it in Rhodesia, and I see it here. I need to learn who's the boss, something you failed to show them.
Johann simply nodded, but he saw another side of the man he worked for, and he didn't like it.
37. I heard the rapid knocking, turned back to the computer and said, Creed, someone's banging on my door, I'll call you back. I disconnected, blacked out the camera, and went to the peephole of our door. I saw Shoshana, showing up 40 minutes early. It was starting to become a trend. I let her in, and she immediately started looking around for Jennifer. Since our room doubled as our Tactical Operations Center, or TOC, I always rented a suite, which meant Shoshana couldn't see everything from the doorway. Sometimes it pays to be in charge. She said, Where's Jennifer? I mimicked her voice.
Oh, hi, Pike. Sorry, I'm early.
I'm sure you didn't have anything going on. She started to move to the bedroom, saying, I want to talk to her. I won't interrupt whatever you're doing. You already have. She turned back to me.